from APM in New York. I'm Ben Johnson, in for David Brancaccio, exploring the latest on how technology is changing our lives and our society. Jeffrey Rosen, legal affairs editor at The New Republic, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, set the scene a year ago. What was this big meeting or set of meetings? Who was there? Where was it? And what was being decided?
So this was a meeting last May, and it was at Stanford Law School. It occurred in the faculty lounge in a very low-key vibe. There were bagel and fruit platters around, and there were a series of young people, some of them wearing T-shirts and unusual footwear, who were mixing with European parliamentarians and civil libertarians and academics like me who'd been invited to join the discussion. But these young people were really the center of attention because they were a group of tech executives who are responsible for drafting and enforcing their company's content policies. They are the ones who decide what controversial speech stays up and what has to come down in response to complaints from users or from governments around the globe. And I call them the deciders. And this is a sort of affectionate tribute to Nicole Wong, who's the legal director at Twitter. Her former colleagues at Google called her the decider when she was at Google because she was responsible for deciding what content stayed up and what came down, not only on Google but also YouTube, which Google owns. And what was so interesting about this meeting is it united people like Wong with representatives from other leading tech companies, including Facebook and Twitter, and put them all in the same room and asked them to discuss the challenges and opportunities of enforcing content policies around the globe. So if you really wanted to come up with a small group of people, this was not more than two dozen, who had more power over free speech, more power over who can speak and who can be heard than anyone around the globe, more power than any king or president or Supreme Court justice, it'd be hard to come up with a group better than this one.
Now, you point in your piece, you point towards some sort of interesting ideas about the next decade of free speech online. And you sort of suggest that some of the big free speech battles are not going to actually take place in places like China, and not sort of be about some of these governments and places that we think of as stifling free speech, but actually in some other surprising places. Tell me what the balkanization of the internet is.
Some of the deciders are concerned that the great threats to free speech in the next decade will come not from China, as you suggest, but instead from places like Europe. Europe has a very different approach to free speech than the U.S. does. In Europe, it's permissible to ban speech that amounts to a kind of group libel or defamation on the basis of race or religion or national origin. And in the course of the perfectly worthy effort to protect groups against offense, the deciders are concerned that European democracies are going to demand the suppression of increasing amounts of speech that might even allow for the suppression of political dissent. The obvious example is the Innocence of the Muslim videos, which President Obama and the President of Europe demanded the removal of, but the deciders decided to keep it up. And basically the argument against the video was a form of group libel or defamation. The idea is that it was an insult against Muslims. But the deciders at Facebook and Google looked at the video and concluded in a matter of hours under great pressure that although the video did insult the Prophet Muhammad, it did not insult Muslims as a group. And for that reason, they concluded it didn't violate either of their content policies, which prohibits insults against groups on the basis of religion but not religious leaders. They decided to keep the video up in most cases, although Google did temporarily remove it in Egypt and Syria because of violence on the ground, and later in Russia and India, where it's clearly illegal. Facebook left it up everywhere. And in retrospect, I think that the young deciders, under great pressure, made a better decision, more conducive to protecting free speech than the President of the United States.
So Now, the distinction here, which you're touching on, is a kind of distinction between groups and institutions, right? There's a difference between Islam and Muslims, and there's a difference between the Pope and Catholics. Is that right?
That's exactly right, and that's the distinction that's central to the hate speech policies of both Facebook and Google. Interestingly, it doesn't appear in U.S. constitutional law, and it doesn't appear in European law either. Both companies embraced it for different reasons on their own. At Facebook, it was essentially proposed by the young decider who's in charge of enforcing Facebook's content policy. His name is Dave Wilner. He's 28 years old now. He joined Facebook right out of college, where he was working on the help desk answering user emails, but he quickly rose to the top of the content team. And he essentially drafted this policy on his own. He had come out of college. He concluded that vague language prohibiting hostile and offensive working environment, which is what American workplaces and universities tend to use to police hate speech, was too subjective to be applied by 22-year-old deciders in a matter of seconds around the globe, especially given the fact that they're spread out in offices from India to Ireland, as well as Austin, Texas, and Menlo Park. So he just wanted a more objective standard that could be applied based on information in the four corners of the reports filed by Facebook users, and that's how he came up with this distinction between criticism of a group on the basis of religion, which is impermissible, versus criticism of a religious or political leader, which is permissible, and that's the distinction that ended up protecting the innocence of the Muslim video.
So we're getting a sense here about how these codes are being written and who is writing them. How are they being enforced?
They're being enforced by, once again, very young people, often wearing the same uniform of T-shirts and flip-flops. And these young people are distributed around the world. Basically, at both Facebook and Google, the initial demands to take material down often comes from the force of, often takes the form of user complaints. At YouTube, any user can flag a particular video as violating community guidelines. And those user complaints are sent initially to the so-called first responders, who are these very young people sitting around in laptops in the various offices around the globe, and they have to make a split-second decision, literally often in a matter of seconds, about whether or not the material violates the policy. And in tough cases, if they're not quite sure about whether the policy is implicated, then they can escalate the material up to their supervisors in Silicon Valley. And at Facebook, those people are led by Dave Wilner, and he and his team of six people who supervise about 100 first responders will make the ultimate decision about whether or not to take down the material.
Now, you were at these meetings. You are a law professor. And I think it's really interesting. You know, I personally, my biggest memory of someone being called the decider is President George W. Bush.
Exactly.
And there's obviously a shift happening here, at least in this, you know, topic area, in terms of who is the decider. And it sounds from your piece like it's shifting towards young people in the tech industry. Now, you sound in your piece, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem relatively sanguine about this. What are your concerns?
You're absolutely right, first of all, to say that there's been a totemic shift in the power of who gets to control speech. It used to be President Woodrow Wilson who would prosecute Eugene V. Debs for criticizing World War I. It used to be state officials. Now it's moved to the young tech executives at companies like Google and Facebook. And I do think that under tough circumstances, they're doing a relatively good job of balancing competing pressures. But I still do indeed have concerns. The main one I have is it's a huge responsibility for young people, some of them without legal training and without the supervision of the courts and, more importantly, constitutional standards. The main concern I have is that Google and Facebook, although they exercise the powers of governments, are not formally bound by the U.S. Constitution. They're corporate actors rather than state actors, and therefore, although they may be voluntarily doing a pretty good job at approximating and enforcing U.S. First Amendment concerns, they're under no legal obligation to do so, and they're also struggling with competing pressures. They're responsible not only for upholding free speech, but also for keeping the bottom line of their shares high in order to satisfy their shareholders and fiduciary responsibilities. So the concern I have about the deciders is the same one that I would have about any system where you're essentially asked to trust the king, trust the government, trust the powers. Here it's trust the deciders. I'm impressed with the job they're doing, but trust us is not a model that the U.S. Constitution is built around. We've distributed and separated power and created oversight systems to avoid the dangers of concentrated authority. And it's not clear, given the huge magnitude of responsibility that these young people are exercising, that the decider model is a stable one for the future.
Push this forward for me a little bit, if you would, in terms of how this might play out 15, 20 years from now, which is hard for any of us to imagine. But what you're talking about is, you know, once again, this seismic shift that we've all been talking about since, I don't know, since I was a freshman in college and studying government of, you know, the people in sort of power of making some of these decisions being private entities as opposed to public entities. In terms of the online world, what are the potential, the potential negative impacts of this kind of thing going forward if there aren't checks and balances?
The potential negative impacts are that, first of all, the scope of the responsibility will become overwhelming. At Facebook right now, more than a billion pieces of content are posted every day. And the idea that each of these pieces of content could be thoughtfully reviewed by 100 or so first responders and evaluated neutrally by a team of six or so deciders may prove to be impractical. But there's also the concern that at the moment, the deciders have pretty broad discretion to enforce their content policies as they think best. That freedom will be increasingly challenged by laws passed not only by Europe, which is clamoring for new laws prohibiting group libel, but also from authoritarian countries like China and Russia and Uzbekistan, all of whom convinced the UN's International Telecommunications Union in December to approve an ominous series of international norms and rules standardizing the behavior of countries concerning information and cyberspace. Essentially, the whole information yearns to be free model could be very easily challenged by new multinational UN laws that require the erection of firewalls and censoring mechanisms and blockages. I'm also concerned about European laws such as the so-called right to be forgotten, which is being debated by the European Commission, and if adopted, it could allow any individual to demand the deletion of content, not only that they posted themselves, but also content that others have posted about them, even if it's true, as long as it's embarrassing. And a European Privacy Commissioner gets to decide whether it's necessary for journalistic, scientific, or literary purposes, but because the law would impose on the Internet service providers a fine of up to 2% of their annual income, which in Google's case is $50 billion, that means that Google could be liable for up to $1 billion per incident if they fail to guess right about whether a European privacy officer would find that content was necessary for journalism or science. And that could essentially convert the deciders from administrators of a neutral platform into censors-in-chief for the entire world. They'd have a tremendous discretion to remove, in the face of any objection, in order to avoid liability. That would very much change their role, and it could also easily be abused by governments that were trying to insulate themselves from criticism, invoking so-called laws against dignitary offenses. So this really may be a golden age, a brief epoch of libertarian freedom, where these young deciders have a lot of leeway to operate with a free hand, but that could change sooner rather than later.
Jeffrey Rosen, legal affairs editor at The New Republic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.